You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Kathy Sellers was learning how to drive a truck, her instructor would show her pornographic images on his smartphone and threaten her with physical and sexual violence, often with a steak knife in his hand. For women in trucking, stories like Kathy's are not unusual. Over the past 20 years, hundreds of women have brought gender discrimination claims against the industry, dealing with everything from catcalls to rape. For an article titled Surviving the Long Haul, Mary Pallon investigated the reports made by women and uncovered an unresponsive, often retaliatory system that denies them justice. The article is published in Mary Review and reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. I'm very pleased it has brought Mary Pallon to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And haven't you just flown in from Rio where you covered the Olympics?
Yes, I was there.
This is quite a different story.
Yes, I was there as a TV producer for NBC, so I've definitely been switching gears really quickly.
You write about sports and switching gears. I got the point. Okay.
Yes, I write mostly about sports and business as a freelancer. And this story, it was published a while ago, but it took, probably 12 to 18 months to report. And a story like this, both the process it takes to put it together and the subject matter, is one that definitely sticks with you.
What led you into sexual abuse in the trucking industry?
So this story, it's really interesting how it came about. I was, I grew up in Oregon, and I was out in Coos Bay about a year and a half ago reporting a totally different story about the runner Steve Prefontaine, and I was parked and I saw logging trucks rolling by, which is a very common sight for anybody who grew up in the Northwest. And one rolled by and it was driven by a woman. And in all the years I'd spent in the Northwest and in New York, I'd never seen that. So I immediately contacted an editor who's now at Bloomberg Business Week, who I work with a lot. And I said, how fascinating, because in sports and business, I didn't start out thinking I was a gender reporter, but it ends up becoming part of the beat because there is such disparity in both of those worlds. And I thought, wow, let's talk to some women in trucking. I knew there was a shortage in the industry, so I was just curious, what is the landscape like? And I started calling around, and very quickly this issue, it was one of the first things that one person after another talked to me about.
Should we be surprised? 96% of all truckers are male?
Correct. So it's one of the starkest gender gaps, just in terms of the numbers. And something else about the trucking industry, which I had to kind of educate myself on, is that the turnover is really, really fast. And there's a shortage. And the trucking industry...
And why is there a turnover? Nobody lasts more than a year. And we're talking about instructors as well as truckers.
Correct. If you're a male or a female, trucking's it's a tough gig. Physically, it can be very, very hard. The hours are really rough. You're talking about a lot of time away from friends and family. You don't necessarily need a college degree, but you do need to get a commercial driver's license, go through some schooling. And it's a tough life. I mean, there's been a lot of research about things, whether it's diabetes or obesity or hearing problems. Life on those rigs is really, really challenging, especially if you're just starting out.
And why would women want to get into this?
So I was fascinated with some of the reasons why the women were getting into it. One thing to keep in mind is the average woman in trucking is in her 50s. And time again, I was finding that a lot of women, this was a second act. So maybe they had gone through a divorce. Maybe they were done raising children. Maybe they never had the opportunity to go to college. And they really prized the idea of having a new career, independence, the very things that might turn some people off from the job, the isolation. They loved the idea of the open road. It was a very romantic notion. So it was a very specific kind of woman. A lot of them were very tough and had a lot of life experience.
And it doesn't take extra strength to drive these trucks anymore, does it?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that like any job that's that has kind of crazy hours, you have to be able to be up in the morning, at night, whatever the drive may require. But physically, no. I mean, it's easier than ever.
How often did you hear about experiences like Kathy's while you were reporting on this?
Often. I spoke to dozens of men and women in the industry, and the things that they would tell me ranged from catcalling at truck stops to all allegations of all-out rape. And one of the things that I didn't realize is that the trucking industry, the parallels to the military came up a lot. And actually, some of the women I spoke to were also military veterans, and they talked about the structure of the system. So not only is there a gender imbalance, as you had said, but the chain of command and reporting these things, whether it was a catcall or something far more serious, that was something that was problematic.
Was it similar to their experiences in the military?
In some cases, yes. I mean, one of the things with trucking to keep in mind is that you have a dispatcher, and that person keeps track of the loads, and their job is to make sure things run on time, that loads get delivered. And if that's the first person you're supposed to convey displeasure or an issue with, they might say, well, that's fine, but can you get there on time? There might be a conflict of interest.
How does the lack of skilled drivers because of all the turnover affect the way managers staff and dispatch trucks?
So one of the things a lot of women told me is that because trucking companies are so desperate to have people operating these rigs, a lot of behavior that in a lot of workplaces might not be tolerated was okay in trucking. So, for example, if you complained about a male driver, even if several women complained about a single driver, he might just be put on sabbatical for a bit and put back on the roads later, rather than a zero tolerance policy you'd see in a lot of workplaces.
And that's because they work in teams?
Correct. So team trucking, there's two types of trucking. There's when you have a single person on the road, and then team trucking, which, as the name implies, means you have two drivers on a rig. So sometimes these are husband-wife teams, sometimes it's two men. But also, because it's kind of a hectic industry and there's a shortage, it's one lawyer called it a square dance, where you're pairing people together. Often you will be paired with a male. This is also how training goes if you're a female. And that, from a sexual harassment perspective, is a perfect recipe for disaster. You have two people out alone in isolation.
Well, since there have been problems, why don't they just team two women?
So there's a fascinating legal history to that, too. One company did try to do that. But then what was happening is women were waiting forever and ever and ever on the sidelines to be paired with another woman. So the courts have said that that is not allowed. And one of the aftershocks of that lawsuit has been a greater awareness by companies of these issues and trying to create a culture in which this doesn't become an issue in the first place.
My guest is Mary Pallon, who has written an article called Surviving the Long Haul. It's in Mary Review. Much of your reporting focuses on the West Coast terminal of a trucking company called CRST International in Riverside, California. Is that a large company?
Yes. CRST is one of the largest team trucking companies in the country, and they have some of the biggest clients that most of us would know. And they also operate a huge trucking school. So a lot of trainers and drivers will start their careers there.
They actually claim to be the nation's largest team carrier and family-owned company. This is from the website. They say that's been since 1955. CRST is financially sound and believes in giving our drivers the best training, the newest equipment, and the latest in technology. You'll get the most miles in the industry, make good money, and receive guaranteed home time. CRST has opportunities for both company drivers and owner-operators. And then it lists a number of different trucking companies that a prospective driver can choose from.
Correct. And a lot of these schools, what they do is they make a pitch very similar to what you were describing, and then will waive the cost of tuition contingent on you staying in the company for a while. And a lot of the women I spoke with said that that was a big problem for them because they were worried about complaining because they didn't want to jeopardize their ability to work for another company, to stay with that company, or have debt if they walked away. And that's something that we didn't get into too much with this particular story, but the finances of the training and the pipeline was really interesting in how they created this dynamic.
Do you think you would have found a similar story if you'd gone into a major trucker in New York or Chicago?
Well, it's tricky to try to classify the trucking industry by geography. Inherently, folks are all over the place. And I talked to women who had routes along the Northeast, in the Midwest, on the West Coast, all over, because with a story like this, you really want to make sure that you're pointing the lens in the right direction, that this is a pattern, that these aren't isolated cases. And what was fascinating about how these women communicate with each other now is that technology has played a huge role. So you'd end one conversation, they'd say, oh, but I have a friend who I've been texting in Colorado, you should talk to her. Oh, I have a friend in Washington State you should talk to. And so for the first time, I think, in the history of the industry, a lot of these women who in the past may have felt very, very isolated and statistically are still quite rare are connecting and supporting each other.
Connecting through a group called Real Women in Trucking?
Yes.
How does that distinguish itself from Women in Trucking?
So Women in Trucking is a group that has a lot more industry ties. And Real Women in Trucking was started by a group of women who are drivers themselves. And that's something that was, when I talked to a lot of women, they made a big distinction about the difference between women who might have side positions in the industry, whether it's as receptionists or in offices, and the women who were on the rigs. And there was a big gap in the description of experience. And so Real Women in Trucking has a lot more female drivers specifically.
You write that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission received 414 complaints from women truckers between 2005 and 2015 alone. How significant is that given the number of the women in the industry?
Given how few women there are, it's pretty striking that there's that many complaints. And also, like a lot of sexual harassment cases, there are many deterrents for complaining in the first place, whether it's, you know, shame and the more psychological aspects of what's happened and the trauma and wanting to talk about that publicly. These are a lot of women who have felt that even when they did complain, things didn't happen. So for that number to be that high, given those barriers, was pretty striking to me.
And there's another striking statistic. On average, nearly one in six of these women cite race as part of the nature of the claim, and almost two-thirds experience retaliation as a result of reporting harassment.
Right. The racial dimension of this can't be understated. And what I found in talking to women of color particularly is they would get some of the same comments and catcalls, but often with a racial slur mixed in there. One woman who is Latina told me that people assumed she was a prostitute and would say things about Mexico, but she wasn't from Mexico. And I mean, just awful, awful stuff that came up over and over and over again. And some of the cases actually threw in racial discrimination claims as well. It seems like they went hand in hand.
And Native American women, too.
Yes, there was a case with a Native American woman, too, where that came up over and over. And the other thing to keep in mind is putting these cases through the courts is a legal is tough anyway, inherently. So whether it was in court documents where we were finding these claims or in conversations, that was a repeated thing. And what we know about diversity, whether it's gender or racial, is that it breeds better workplaces. One of the things that happens is that there's more checks and balances, and people, it creates a culture where people feel more welcome. And in trucking, I think there's a lot of work that could be done to make the industry far more diverse.
You want to talk about that case that involved the Native American woman?
So Ona Red Hat.
Ona Red Hat?
Yes. So she was a woman who filed a case. I can't remember the year off of the top of my head. But she claimed that a lot of what she would encounter was at truck stops. And keep in mind that truck stops, I think a lot of drivers, if you're driving a car, you just stop by. But for a trucker, those are critical places. That's where there's a lot of resting, eating, showering if necessary. So she was driving and training that, So she said that she was required to hold another driver's hand and pretend that they were a couple when they were at a truck stop. And that her trainer had made comments to her and his dispatcher about other drivers calling them, you know, dumb blank Mexicans, that he told her sexual jokes.
He said CRST stood for constantly raping student drivers.
Yes.
And then he touched her while she slept.
Yes.
So
yes.
That sounds to me like a pretty strong case.
Yes, but the details are horrifying, no doubt about it. But what's tricky about sexual harassment cases, and particularly this kind of sexual harassment case, is that you have two people. It's a very unique workplace. You don't have other witnesses. You don't have other people around. And over I heard women who said they were so frustrated because they would complain and somebody would say, well, it's his word against yours. And it would just kind of die there. And the other thing to keep in mind is that one of the things I thought was interesting was a lot of the male drivers would take a woman's cell phone, and then the Qualcomm on board, which is what truckers use to dispatch, you know, a home base, that would be viewable by both. So even their mechanism for complaining would be taken away. So pursuing these claims, you know, however horrible the details may be, there's still a gap between that and a court of law.
And what kinds of retaliation do women face if they report harassment incidents?
A lot of women told me that they were worried about maybe not getting certified to become a driver. They were worried about not being put on the road, or maybe they wanted to become trainers themselves. So they were worried about opportunities for advancement. And the other thing with trucking is that it's a very reputation-based industry. So they really wanted to be there to work and not have be seen as a problem to prospective employers.
And there was a possibility of being blacklisted.
Correct. And that was something that came up, especially because the turnover is so high, your reputation really, really matters.
I'm speaking with Mary Pilon, P-I-L-O-N. Her article, Surviving the Long Haul, is in Mary Review. It was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund of the Nation Institute. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Mary Pilon. She's an author and a freelance journalist, and her latest article is called Surviving the Long Haul. It's in the Mary Review, and it was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. You've been reporting, as I mentioned earlier, from Rio on the Olympics. Where will that appear?
Oh, I was working as a TV producer for NBC Sports, so it actually, a lot of it already has appeared, and I did a couple of stories for The New Yorker. The Olympics is a land of a million story ideas, so.
You do know that NBC has been criticized for some of its reporting, especially with as far as the reporting on women athletes.
Yes, and you know, to be just a little bit of information, I mean, NBC is a huge, huge company. They send a lot of people to Rio, and the group that I was working with was doing a lot of the features that air before, during, and after live things. So any of the live commentary, that was a completely separate empire from the world I was working on. And one of the things, and I just honestly can't speak to that. I wasn't there. I didn't make any of those decisions, but when I was flying back last night, one of the things I was reading about was the overall coverage of women. I think in sports journalism, I find it's not so much that people are biased or sexist in coverage, although obviously that does happen. It's sometimes that the tournaments just aren't covered. And I love seeing Simone Biles get so much attention. I love that Katie Ledecky got so much attention. And I think if you look at both the medal count and overall, I mean, the U.S. women owned this Olympics.
The reason I even asked is because it's also been reported in sports often that male coaches cross the line with young female that they're working with. So this should be almost expected, even though it's terrible, the story that you're describing here.
Right. And I think that that's something, whether it's trucking or the Olympics or Wall Street, that I've always been interested in is what roles do women have? I looked really hard to find women trainers in trucking, for example, because I really wanted to know. And I found a few, but it was hard. Some of that statistic, but you also want to look at how people are promoted. And one of the things in the sports world, so if you think about Title IX, which is federal legislation that requires, equal funding, and has greatly expanded opportunities for women in the U.S. in sports. I think that's part of why the Olympic team in women's sports was so strong this time around. I've been really interested in coaching. How many of those coaches are women? And unfortunately, not enough. And I think what's interesting about both worlds is that there's a generation gap. If you look at someone like Simone Biles, she was born into a world where Title IX was established. It existed. There's a whole generation of young women that have a different world, different outlook on this. And with trucking, where the average age of a female trucker is in their 50s. I'm curious to see what the picture looks like 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Some of the regulations are federal.
Correct.
Is there a conflict between state and federal regulations, especially for truckers who are crossing state lines all the time?
Yes. One of the things that the federal government really, other than the EEOC, seems to hit into this is with trucking schools, because some do receive Pell Grants, which any of your listeners who are either in school or have a loved one who is, that's federal funding for schools. So that's where it seems to come in. But a lot of the problems aren't necessarily the laws on the books. We have a lot of laws about sexual harassment. It's implementation. It's getting women to complain. It's getting companies that follow those rules and policies that they have.
And even when they complain, you report that sometimes the EEOC drops the ball.
Right. There was a big case a few years ago where many, many women complained, and the case was kind of bungled in court. I talked to a lot of lawyers about it who said it was everything from missing deadlines to the complaints not being written properly. And there's a class action that's on right now that is not being handled by the EEOC, but a different law firm, or a law firm, not the government. And those lawyers said that there have been, you see this actually with a lot of sexual harassment cases. The Roger Ailes case comes to mind, where once one woman steps forward, then there's, 5, 10, 15, 20. And that's what's happening, I think, in trucking now, too.
But also statute of limitations often applies. So if somebody says, And we've seen this with the Cosby case.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did this 20 years ago. It doesn't matter how much proof she has. The statute of limitations protects the perpetrator.
True. And I think that you're seeing that here. What's really harrowing, unfortunately, about trucking, but maybe good from a legal standpoint, is a lot of these are recent complaints. This is a problem that isn't crystallized in history. It isn't in the past as much as we wish it was. So a lot of the complaints and the ones I focused on were in the last few years. So, yes, you know, you're right. I think that's really crushing news for a lot of women. But unfortunately, there's still many, many more fresh complaints.
How does CRST track complaints by female drivers?
So this was something that came up a lot in my reporting, and there was a lot of disagreement.
You spoke to the lawyer,
yes,
Kevin Visser.
He said that they track by driver, and one of the things they'll do is if there's a lot of complaints about a particular male driver, they'll note that in his file with something that says NF, no females. And the lawyers who were particularly pushing this class action on behalf of the women took issue with that. They said, well, so that just means that it's okay to sexually harass someone and you just, you know, you still are on the road just with no women. And then I talked to some male drivers who I asked about this policy and they said, well, I'm not exactly eager about getting on a rig with a guy who has a disciplinary record with women either. So that particular piece of handling it came under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of workplaces. And again, this goes back to the shortage in the industry. I think a lot of industries would just, you know, especially if there were multiple complaints about a single person, say, you know, you need to leave the company.
Didn't you request to see a section of the company's training manual pertaining to sexual harassment from U.S. Kevin Visser, their lawyer?
Yes.
For that?
Yes. So after a lot of these cases in the last 5 or 10 years, companies started having written sexual harassment policies. So if you join a company or you do training with them, they say that they read this policy to you. It's printed out. You have to sign it. He had described it as voluminous. When we actually asked to see it, it was only a couple of pages. And I think especially when you think about starting a new job, you know, there's a lot of information that's thrown at you. You're signing a lot of papers. You're signing your tax forms. You're signing contracts. If you're learning how to become a trucker, you're also getting a ton of information about how the industry works. And I talked to a lot of drivers, male and female, who when I asked, you know, do you remember the sexual harassment policy? Do you remember talking about it? And again, this varies depending on what year they went through it, but there was a really wide array. Some people said, what? You know, what are you talking about? And again, I think that it's one thing to have, I think that's a good step, having a policy, but I think it's another to have it implemented and have a workplace and an environment where people feel like it doesn't have to be, you know, recited every few months, that people are really living it out day to day as they go about their jobs.
My guest is Mary Pilon. Her article is Surviving the Long Haul. It's in Mary Review, and it was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund of the Nation Institute. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I began this by talking about Kathy Sellers, who was learning how to drive a truck, and her instructor would show her pornographic images on a smartphone, threaten her with physical and sexual violence, often with a steak knife in his hand. Did it ever escalate to physical violence?
Yes, she had described that she had been bruised, and that she described being stranded as a result of trying to, you know, escape this. And I mean, I think anybody who'd be alone with a guy with a knife who was making verbal threats would feel physically endangered as well. So she, at one point, when the truck pulled into a rest stop somewhere in New Mexico, she grabs her purse and jumps out of the passenger door. Just as a dispatcher finally had called her, you know, the police arrive, she gets on a bus, she gets the rest of her belongings. And then she also said that at that point she had stopped being paid. And that the morning after, she talked to someone in CRST Human Resources about what happened. And she said that she gave even more details than what she'd given to the police and was told that, you know, someone would look into it. And that her neck and back injuries, you know, she got treatment for. But she said that, you know, she was frustrated with how CRST handled her complaints after that. And then she ultimately joined this class action case that we'd been talking about.
And when she called to check the status of the case with her human resources department, a representative allegedly told her that it was none of her business?
Yes. And this was something that came up a lot as well. You're in a murky area, right? Because if someone accuses someone of sexual harassment, the company looks into it, but also that person has a right to defend themselves. And it was really hard for these women to figure out whether they were respecting another guy's privacy or ignoring them. So there's a very murky landscape here. And I think that'd be really frustrating if you're on the complaining side of things. And sometimes they wouldn't even receive a follow-up call. I mean, now, you know, there were some women I talked to who said, you know, I complained, and then someone from Human Resources called me after and asked, you know, about the details, and they felt like someone was listening. And then there were some where that follow-up call just never happened.
But don't trucking companies mandate that the drivers stay in touch with supervisors while they're on the road?
Yes.
Wouldn't that cut down on the sort of activity?
Ideally, yes. But the Qualcomm, the machine that a lot of truckers use, is shared between two drivers. So in other words, if you were complaining about somebody, they would be able to see your complaint. A lot of women have mobile devices, but some of the men that they were, you know, accusing of sexual harassment would either take their phones or, you know, ask who you're texting, show me who you're texting or calling. I think one thing that trucking companies have done a better job with is having hotlines available and making it easier for women to reach out. But again, you're in close quarters with somebody nonstop. And, you know, Kathy Sellers told me about how when this was happening, not only were they in the middle of nowhere, but the truck was in motion. I mean, I think something to keep in mind is how different this workplace environment is. It adds so many, many, many challenges to complaining about sexual harassment.
Another woman, Leslie Fortune, reported that her co-driver had been drinking, smoking marijuana, and propositioning her for sex. What happened when she reported that to a manager? You would have thought that would have set up alarm bells.
No. And again, we get back into this conflict of interest, right? That when you complain, they say, you know, can you get your load there on time? And the propositioning for sex was something that came up a lot, unfortunately. And that her fleet manager actually like laughed at her, she told me, and said, well, you guys can figure that out. You know, you two should work it out, which is really, you know, really, really frustrating.
An exception to all of this is a case from 2005 involving a woman named Karen Shank. She won. It was one of the biggest wins. What distinguished that from all of these others?
Yes. Yeah, so the Karen Shank case is a watershed, I think, when we're talking not just about the trucking industry, but also the faith that some women have and what might happen when they complain. So basically what happened is, you know, Shank, she fits the profile of a lot of the women I talked to. She was a divorcee with a high school degree. Her children had been grown up. She had long been fascinated by trucks. She joins the industry. It seemed like the perfect time to make the shift. She goes through training, and she was paired with a driver who she said from the first day on the road began making very sexually charged comments to her and also said things like, what happens on the truck stays on the truck. And he would touch her. At one point, you know, she said that she went to put a sweater on over a tank top, and he asked her not to, saying that she should, quote, give an old man a cheap thrill. She would reject his advances, but didn't want to report any of this because she feared that her training and future at the company would be jeopardized. And she said something that that I heard often, which was this idea that I wasn't out there to meet anybody. I wasn't out there to find a husband or a boyfriend. I wanted to drive. I wanted to drive a truck. So anyway, you know, at one point they had to share a hotel room, which also seems like, you know, alarm bells are going off, I think, for a lot of your listeners. And Shank described that she just found him on top of her, and that she completely froze. And also, as part of that, was really terrified about complaining, and that she just laid there, which is something, unfortunately, you hear a lot. And then the courts...
But when she did complain, they actually sent her a bill for $3,600 for tuition fees.
Yes.
As somebody who's being taught to drive a truck.
Yes. And according to the court statement of facts, the collections representative she talked to laughed and said that she couldn't do anything about it without a police report, which was the catalyst for her suing. And she said, you know, most rape victims think it's their fault, and that she said, no, not this time. And I think it's also worth noting that this lawsuit went on for 5 years, and it was 2 years after the EEOC's failed lawsuit, and that she eventually won a civil case against the company and received a $1.5 million judgment.
But I would imagine that anybody who's listening right now, a woman listening and thinking, well, maybe I'd want to be a truck driver, might reconsider. Is there any hope for the future? Is there any indication that circumstances will improve for female truck drivers?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that perhaps women should take some comfort in is that, like I said earlier, there's a community. They're not alone anymore. There are organizations now of women in trucking. There's a support system. And I do think that some of these lawsuits have had an impact, that companies now are aware that it's a problem. You know, I was really surprised in researching it that there wasn't more written about this. When you think about how critical trucking is to all of us as consumers, it's the food that's on our plates, it's the parts that are for our cars, and, you know, increasingly the things we order online, and that this is a huge part of the economy that impacts all of us. And we all should be paying attention to this. And I think the more that we get aware of this and the more that companies start taking action, and also I think that men are becoming more aware of this. I talked to a lot of men who were very, very concerned about this. And I think, again, that the women who are in the industry now very much see themselves, rightfully so, I think, as trailblazers. They're the ones who are really trying to push for a lot of these changes. It's never been an easy job, but I do think generally that things are getting better.
Mary Pallon's article, Surviving the Long Haul, is in the Mary Review, written in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.